This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Professor Eliza Resconi from the Technische Universität München, which is the Technical University of Munich. Is that right?
Correct, yes. Okay.
Welcome to the Jodcast. Thank you for flying in to do the colloquium and the interview.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is quite exciting because it's quite unusual on the Jodcast that we have any interview that's not about electromagnetic waves. So, at my calculations, it's been about 3.5 years since we had the last one. So, can you tell us what it is that you study or how you are studying the universe?
Okay, well, this is a complicated question. I try to answer in short. Well, we try really to complement what with photons you can do. So, neutrinos travel without basically interacting from very far away or from the core of stars and black holes. So when photons are absorbed, neutrinos will not be absorbed. And so that's in very short the complementarity respect photons.
So these particles, neutrinos, they have mass, which makes them a little bit different to light,
also,
I guess.
Correct, yes.
And, well, perhaps you could start off by telling us how you detect them. You mentioned they don't really interact very much. How do you capture them?
Yeah, well, in principle, they interact very, very rarely. So once you have a huge mass instrumented, like we have, for example, in IceCube, so really you need a huge detector, then once in a while you will be able to see the interaction of neutrinos. So we say they interact weakly, and this means the probability of the interaction is very, very weak or very rare. And so the problem is, of course, to realize these huge detectors, and that's the reason why we don't build a detector, but we use natural material, the ice or water in lakes and oceans. And in this way, we try really to have huge target material.
So IceCube, as you mentioned, that is actually a cube of ice, is it?
It's 1 cubic kilometer cube of ice, yes.
Wow. Since we'll assume that people maybe haven't heard about it before, where do you get this cubic kilometre of ice?
Well, Antarctica is giving this huge amount of target material for free. So this is really the glacier. And so we use the cleanest part of the glacier. The glacier is 3,000 metre tall, so it's a huge amount of ice down there. And we deploy the detector below the surface, so below 1.5 kilometer. And we instrument basically the last kilometer of ice, where the optical properties are particularly clean and nice. So it's a very quiet environment and ideally set for this very rare type of events that we search.
I was going to ask actually why the ice had to be there at the, well, at the South Pole. And you're saying it's sort of pure. So what would happen if you just used, say, some ice out of the freezer, you know, so a very big cube of ice. How would that sort of get in the way of what you're looking for?
Yeah, that actually the ice from our freezer is very different. It's very milky. So people have always in mind this very milky type of ice. And they ask, how can you resist something through? Okay, so the ice is milky in the ice cube in the freezer because air is trapped in the ice.
Right.
Actually, air is dissolved in water. So once we freeze water, then basically air remains trapped. And so what we see, this milkish white color of ice is typically light scattered. Mm. And through this effect, then we cannot see through. But once ice is actually at very high pressure, then air cannot be trapped anymore. And so the ice at the South Pole, I mean, the deep ice, is extremely clean and extremely transparent. One can think, for example, about a piece of glass, a 1 cubic kilometer piece of glass that you have down there for free. So it's very spectacular.
I'm just trying to imagine there is this big piece of ice. Let's say some neutrinos are coming in and interacting with it. How do you detect them? How do you get the detectors in there without spoiling the ice?
Well, we don't spoil the ice at all. You know, neutrinos are produced naturally in the atmosphere, in the Earth. So that is something that happens constantly. So the fact that neutrinos cross the ice happens since ever. We don't produce anything artificial.
I was just thinking more of the actual detecting elements.
Yeah.
Do they stick into the ice or?
Yeah, these are basically quarks. So everything that compose protons and neutrons, so basically the nuclei of water that is down there, of the ice itself. So this is the target material. And once a neutrino at very high energy arrives and basically enter inside the molecular, inside the atom, inside the nuclei of the atom, and once in a while, as I said, produce an interaction. And from this interaction, charged particles are produced. Then what we see actually are the charged particles, not the neutrino itself. So the charged particle then travel through the ice and they produce a bluish type of light. It's called Cherenkov light. And so the photosensors that we have deployed that compose Ice Cube see and detect this Cherenkov light. So from the reconstruction of all of that, so from the detection of the Cherenkov light, we can go back from to the charged particles and then we can go back to the neutrino. So it's a very indirect type of detection what we do.
Yeah.
But it works pretty well. I mean,
are the light detectors embedded into the ice as well?
Yeah, exactly. So the detector is composed by 5,160 light sensors. That's nothing else than this. It's a pretty, let's say, from the hardware point of view, simple. The exceptional part was how to deploy these sensors down there. And but otherwise, yeah, one can think simply one cubic kilometer, very transparent ice, instrumented with a matrix of photosensors.
Okay, that's great. Well, let's talk about the actual things you detected, because we once had an interview before about Ice Cube, but it was still quite early days. It was over 3 years ago. So what sort of neutrinos have you been detecting? Have you been able to work out where some of them are coming from?
Major new and fundamental achievement is that we now believe that we have started to see high-energy astrophysical neutrinos. I insist on high energy because neutrinos have been seen from the Sun and from one Kokolab supernova in 1987. So there have been already two point sources of neutrinos, but these are neutrinos at lower energy and these are produced in nuclear reactions. So what we were looking for were neutrinos at much higher energy that are produced also through different mechanisms, through acceleration in the universe. And so nobody could actually tell us which level of flux, so which number of neutrinos you would really see. So it was a big adventure and a big bet. And so in the moment we actually switched on the full detector in 2010, I think we were the first to be surprised to indeed start to see these neutrinos. And yeah, it's a big achievement, but it's also just starting in a sense. So we have a bunch of these events. Today, I can tell you it's about a little bit more than 50 in integrating 4 years.
And, so it's like one a month.
Yeah. I mean, if we optimize, you know, IceCube collects a lot of events, high frequency detector in a sense, but most of them are background. So it depends a little bit how you identify neutrinos. You reduce sample. So these 50 are, let's say, the golden events. And we have started to use them because we are pretty sure that they are astrophysical. So we have been very hard on the background ejection. So now we know also how to improve the sample. So it's not that we will be stuck on this low statistic forever, but we have just to learn how to handle better the detector itself and the background. But yeah, I think we can speak about 50-ish events coming from the universe.
And how energetic are they, these neutrinos, say, compared to the ones that are coming from flooding out of the sun all the time?
Yeah, they are really much more energetic. We have started to see events at the PeV scale. PeV is 10 to the 15 electron volt. Maybe you want, as a scale for astronomers, the highest energetic photon ever detected was around 10 to the 15 TeV, so 10 to the 12 electron volt. So
we definitely times more energy.
It's about three order of magnitude more energy than the highest energetic photon. Respect the solar neutrinos, we have to scale it. So neutrinos from the sun are produced at around MeV, so 10 to the 6 electron. Volt. So to arrive to 10 to 15 electron volt, you have to scale it up nine order of magnitude, correct? Nine order of magnitude,
yeah.
Yes.
And is each one event a single neutrino that interacts, or do you ever get a bunch within a short time? I mean, or would that be something that happens with a supernova or
yeah,
something like
exactly.
That?
I mean, from the sun, the neutrinos are steady. For the supernova, it's the opposite. They happen in very few seconds. It's just a burst. For what concerns the astrophysical neutrinos, for the moment, they look steady as well, unfortunately. And they look also diffuse. I mean, we haven't been able to identify a specific direction. And this doesn't have to be overinterpreted in a sense, because to pin down single objects, you require much more events. So let's say we are in the so-called diffuse regime, as was supposed to start. I mean, most of the astronomy started with a large background. I think in astrophysics you call it background, everything you cannot pinpoint down to a source.
Yes.
So these astrophysical neutrinos are now our astrophysical background, and we hope to look deeper and being able sooner or later to start to resolve objects. If there are objects close by, then I think we will resolve them. But that's it, I think, is the major challenge now.
Any idea whether they are objects within our galaxy or even extragalactic, extremely distant event?
It's very hard to say. Everything is, in principle, is possible. So from one side, the sky, I mean, we know for sure the universe is very different in neutrinos as in photons, because neutrinos are not absorbed. So indeed, we are collecting everything that has been produced somewhere. And this somewhere could be really also very far. If it is the case that we are seeing neutrinos coming really from extremely far objects, most probably these far objects haven't been seen in other wavelengths, in other photons. Right. So that is not that nice somehow, but probably some component should come from very far, but we don't know how much. From these 50 events, maybe 10, 20 could remain diffused forever. On the other side, we live in an environment where strong accelerator exists. Our galactic center, for example, is quite a strong object. Then why not some of these events could be associated to the galactic center or to other objects in our galaxy, as well as extragalactic objects. So the high energy universe is full of interesting, strong monster. So there are a lot of scenarios and a lot of theories as well. So I think that is our work now to figure this out a little bit.
Well, 50 big events is a good start. Obviously, there'll be lots of more to come and lots of interpretation. Do we think there could be such a thing as a cosmic neutrino background in the same way as there's a cosmic microwave background originating from the early universe? And would you expect to pick that up or to be able to distinguish it from other sources?
This again pushes us in another energy regime. The relic neutrinos should be also there, and they should be really at extremely low energy, much lower than even the sun. To detect this, there are people thinking to detect relic neutrinos at the electron volts case or even below. The flux should be very high, but the cross section for neutrinos grow with energy. This means that lower you go in energy, even harder will become the detection of them. So I don't really know today how we will be able to access these very low energy neutrinos. So maybe somebody else know that, but I don't.
Well, I guess we're looking at it from an astrophysical point of view because we're an astronomy podcast, but do you also have an interest in any neutrinos that are not from very distant sources, any that are more local? Is that a target for IceCube 2?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we really hope to identify at least some close by object. But as I said before, since neutrinos are not absorbed, our horizon, so our, in a sense, neutrino horizon is huge. Mm-hmm. And so then it's hard to guess. As I said, there are close by very strong objects, blazars, for example, Hillux, or could also happen a gamma ray burst not too far away, or things like this can trigger a detection.
So we're saying close by, but you're still talking about sort of, I guess, tens of millions of light years?
Yes, that says still so already quite far, you're right.
Are there any terrestrial sources that get in the way? I mean, this may seem a silly question, but does the Large Hadron Collider, for example, kick out bursts of neutrinos?
It's a very good question indeed. And I can tell you, very high energy neutrinos, the PV, so 10 to the 15 electron volts, happens to be exactly, so if you transform the PV, we always work in the reference frame of the particle. And for example, the LHC works in the reference frame of the center of mass, right? So if you transform, this is a very simple transformation, you end up with exactly the same energy scale as the center of mass at LHC. And this was one of the first thing I did, for example, and I was surprised. I was thinking, oh my goodness, is it possible at all that maybe LHC is going to produce these neutrinos? And of course it's not, because, you know, you should assume that all the mass produced in an interaction in the core of LHC will go in one single particle, namely a neutrino. Mm-hmm. Moreover, this neutrino should then go in the direction of IceCube and somehow interact. So this is really not feasible, but in a sense, so this is not the background for us. And I can tell you, I investigated that seriously because I got sort of scared from this very strong coincidence. It's just a coincidence.
This is not enough events coming from, not enough neutrinos coming from the LHC.
No, and the energy that actually LHC can produce. I mean, the center of mass is really the same, but you know, they produce always a huge amount of particles. So per particle, then the energy is much lower. So here we are looking really for one single part that cares all the energy produced in this interaction. So this can't happen, essentially. Okay. You cannot bring all the energy in one particle down there. I can tell you, no, there are no background sources on Earth, nor actually extraterrestrial sources. What is the background for part of the astrophysical neutrino is the atmosphere.
Right. Yeah.
And in the atmosphere, so cosmic ray interact in the atmosphere and they produce also a lot of particles. And for us, there are two components that are important for the background. One is the muon component. This is a penetrating component, so arrive actually in the detector, even if we are below the surface, 1.5 kilometers. And then, of course, the neutrinos produced in the atmosphere, so the atmosphere neutrinos. These neutrinos are lower energy, a little bit at lower energy, and so that's the reason why we always speak about high-energy neutrinos, so where essentially atmosphere neutrinos are extremely rare, and so we know the background is nearly zero. It's never zero background, but somehow you are in a safe region.
Yeah. Well, just to give everyone an idea, because they might not know that much about particle physics, I don't think I do either. You mentioned the muon, so there's these three, as we know now, three species of neutrino, the electron, muon, and tau.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just give us an idea of what you're sensitive to? Are you sensitive to all of those types? And also, just to give us a statistical picture, how likely is it that a single neutrino passing through the ice mm-hmm. actually interact?
Ice Cube can see all three types of neutrinos, electron, muon, tau. The interactions are different, and so actually we cannot really identify which one is an electron neutrino, which one is a tau neutrino. Muon neutrinos are, let's say, the easy one because they have a specific topology. I mean, they induce a muon, and as I said, the muon is actually traveling. It's a very penetrating particle, and so travel kilometers if it's high energy. And so we see a long of light, and so this is simple somehow to disentangle from the others. The others produce, so electron neutrinos and tau neutrinos produce just a blob of particles, so more spherical like, and so we cannot really say this is an electron neutrino or a tau neutrino, but we collect all of them to answer the first question. And the second question about the cross-section, so what is the probability to see them? Well, cross-section is of the order of 10 to the minus 20. Then, as I said, depends on the energy. So this is really very, very small. But again, you can compensate that instrumenting a lot of matter, so you can just scale it with the volume.
So just being a little bit more speculative, sometimes people have talked about neutrinos as being possibly what we call dark matter, although it seems as though that idea is generally disfavored. So obviously neutrinos, they share some things in common with dark matter, which is that they don't interact very much.
Mm-hmm.
Could they be the sort of 90% of matter that seems to be unexplained in the universe?
So neutrinos, we know they have a mass, and we don't know the absolute scale of the mass, but we know the mass is very, very small of the three neutrinos. And so if you use this level of masses, you don't really manage to get the dark matter out there. There could be a fourth neutrino, and we call it sterile. And theoretically, from this particle physics point of view, is a quite natural, actually, extension. So, and this poor sterile neutrino will not be able even to interact weakly, so we basically don't do anything. And there are measurements that are sort of indicating a mass of this sterile neutrino at higher scale. So, if the sterile neutrino exists, this hasn't been proved yet. This sterile neutrino could be a good candidate for dark matter.
But they just interact via gravity, would they?
Then basically will be only a particle that you can see by gravity. They will not do anything, nothing electromagnetically nor weakly interacting.
Do we know how they might be produced?
Yeah, well, I mean, since the standard neutrinos have a mass, we know that they should be, now I use a technical word, the right-handed partner. So in the standard model, all particles are left and right-handed. The only thing is that the weak interaction works only with left-handed particles. So all neutrinos that will be right-handed somehow will be insensitive. They cannot interact in weak terms. And so they might exist, but we cannot see them. We cannot communicate with them in any way using any force apart the gravity. And the fact is that some neutrino experiments, they don't match, I mean, the results don't match perfectly with the assumption from the standard model of particle physics. So there are tensions in various experiments. And just adding a fourth neutrino, sterile neutrino, then suddenly the measurements match much better. So, but it's all very weak statistically. So it's too early to say that this really exists, a sterile neutrino. But nevertheless, if this sterile neutrino would exist, will be heavier, and so could be then a good candidate for dark matter. So it's a bit complicated, but there is a possibility, not for the standard neutrinos, but maybe for the Sierra neutrino.
Okay. Well, just almost the last thing then. You are going to talk about something that, I have to admit, I don't know anything about except that it's got a nice name called Pingu.
Yes.
Is this an extension to Ice Cube? It's an acronym, P-I-N-G-U.
Yes, right.
What will that do?
So Pingu is a great project. Actually, I'm collaborating with a group here in Manchester, Pingu. And this is completely different. It's really particle physics. It's under design, so it's not yet in the ice, and will be possibly deployed inside Ice Cube. It's the same technology, essentially, as Ice Cube, but the spacing of the photosensor will be different, will be just smaller. And so with the spacing, we can optimize the detection at different scales. So smaller is the scale, the spacing, smaller will be also the energy of the neutrinos we detect. We want to detect, in that case, neutrinos produced in the atmosphere, what is actually the background for the astrophysical neutrinos. Now we become a signal. With the precision measurements of atmospheric neutrinos, we try to disentangle one important thing concerning the neutrino masses. This, again, a little bit technical, not simple to explain to an audience that is not in particle physics active, but the point is that, as I said, there are three neutrinos. They have masses. We know that the first neutrino, so now, in terms of masses, you have to use, you call them nu1, nu2, and nu3, not anymore electron muon tau.
Okay,
and we know that the new one is a little bit lighter than the new two. This has been done in an experiment using solar neutrinos. What we don't know yet is if the new three is lighter or heavier. This is called neutrino mass hierarchy, and it's not just a curiosity, right? It's not that just we want to know that. It's really a fundamental parameter in the model. The understanding of the neutrino mass hierarchy is question number one open in particle physics for the leptonic sector. And we can do this measurement in a relatively cheap way using Pingu. And so using the same technology of Ice Cube, using atmospheric neutrinos that are there always, so a beam that is always on, and using our Earth as a laboratory. And so we have done all the calculation, and this is really promising, and we hope to get the funds to go back to the pole and deploy Pingu and do this very, really, the P in Pingu means precision.
Okay.
So precision measurement of particle physics. It's very exciting.
Fantastic. Yeah, I can't even imagine trying to weigh something as little as a neutrino.
Correct, yes.
That'll be really interesting. All right, this is a very last question, and it's not really to do with physics, but have you worked out at the South Pole, and what's it like out there?
Yeah, I never, you know, working at the South Pole is like more or less, with an experiment, the South Pole is like having your detector on a satellite, more or less. So I have been never at the South Pole personally, as for example the PI of Ice Cube, but that is not a big limitation, so I cannot really answer you how it is working from there.
But people spend the winter there, do they?
Yeah.
I mean, when it's possibly one of the only places on Earth that is really uninhabitable, unless you're, as you said, as if you were on another planet or in space or
yes.
something. So presumably, do they have to stay inside? Do they go out in spacesuits? Or
yeah, well, no, not really in spacesuits, but it's very remote and isolated. But at the South Pole, there is a huge station, so the infrastructure is meanwhile pretty good. There is a small community, about 50 people, that winter there, so they stay there basically 1 year, a little bit longer than 1 year. And between, let's say, February and October, the station is isolated. And I think that is probably psychologically the worst part of being there that long. Apart, of course, the light, that you have a busy, long night to face, or lack of light. I think probably to be isolated is very hard for the community down there. And so I always enjoy when our winter over come back and they share their experience. Most of them are very positive. Few of them are quite scaring, but nothing bad never happens. So it's sort of pretty, sort of safe place to be. You have, of course, to be a special character, I think, to be there. Some of them tell, well, that was short and they love to go back. Yeah. So I, from the stories of the others, I collect usually very positive feedback.
And so people sometimes have to go outside to fix it. Things even during the winter, because can it be sort of minus 70?
It's about minus 50, minus 60.
Okay. Do they need breathing equipment and so on to actually go outside?
No, not really. I mean, they have special equipment because it's extremely cold, and they usually a mask, but this is just for basically filtering a little bit the air, and it's not actually helping the breathing. It's enough what is out there. But yeah, they have to be very careful. So that's, I think, the most dangerous part of that. But again, people are trained very well before. Only very healthy people can travel there. There is a medical doctor at the South Pole. There's also psychologists at the South Pole. So I think they select people that are in good shape. And most of the time, things works pretty well.
It's remarkable that an experiment goes on there. But I guess that is the place on Earth to have it.
I think, 20 years ago when the idea of Ice Cube was born, you know, neutrino astronomy, the first idea was to deploy such a detector in water in close to Hawaii. And then it didn't work out pretty well because, I mean, to deploy on a liquid surface is very difficult, and to go far offshore is also extremely logistically complicated. And so then people moved to a solid base, and there is an experiment in the Lake Baikal using really the winter frozen lake to deploy, and then the South Pole. And of course, back then was incredibly ambitious to deploy anything down there. You know, we didn't know even the optical properties very well of the ice, and it was not clear at all that things like this would succeed. And so I think for people that actually went through the entire development, is amazing that this detector works fantastically. Actually, it's very stable, so it seems that the environment is extremely good for this type of detector, so eventually now it seems simple.
That's great. Well, good luck with the rest of IceCube and particularly with Pingu.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.